Season 2 of Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast is brought to you by RamFit. Here at RamFit, we take material destined for landfill and turn it into high-performance training gear that lasts because we believe we can have fitter people and a fitter planet. In the dynamic world of fitness equipment, our indestructible training tools made from recycled materials promises to revolutionize your workouts and deliver unmatched durability. By embracing the RamFit philosophy, you're not only enhancing your workouts, but also contributing to a more sustainable future. RamFit. Fitter people, fitter planet.
That's right. Ricardo's Rules of Resilience. Tune in, people. Every episode is impactful. You become more burly just by listening. Let's go.
Welcome, everybody, to the Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast, the podcast where we give you the tools to withstand and recover from difficulties. I'm your co-host, Coach Alton, along with Coach Ricardo. And today, you guys, we got another super special guest for you guys. I normally reserve the title of most interesting man in the world for my Uncle David, but it's pretty fitting that he connected us with you. And thank you for coming on today, Bobby Petras.
Yeah, thanks for having me. And Dave's definitely the most interesting man in the world, but I appreciate the shout out.
All right, close second with all that you got going on. I'm definitely excited to divulge into it more. So for the people that may not know who you are, give us a quick elevator pitch on who you are and what you're about.
Sure. So yeah, Bobby Petras, I'm 43 years old. I co-founded a company called Priority Life Care with my sister, Sevi. We are in about our 16th year of operation. My main business is we own and operate assisted living communities, so assisted living, memory care, independent living. We have 72 locations across 15 different states, roughly 3,500 employees. And then with my sister, I think we own 11 other businesses, construction maintenance company, a pharmacy, a lab, a hospice company, a wellness company, several other kind of ancillary companies that support our main business. And then I've been in the fitness world for the last 11 or 12 years. I've owned a gym called Mad Apple CrossFit here in Fort Wayne. And then a few years ago, we started Mad Apple Sports Performance, which focuses primarily on sports performance for kids, either grade school, high school, college, and even some professional athletes. And then my wife and I started a travel softball organization a little over a year ago called Mad Apple Softball. And then, my real passion, along with my wife is, helping underprivileged youth in sports. And so we started the Bobby and Brandy Petras Sports Foundation a couple years ago, and we do as much work with kids as we can.
Yeah, that's great to hear all the great things you got going on in the community, especially right there in Fort Wayne, Indiana. I love to hear that.
Yeah, we love it. I mean, Fort Wayne's great. I've lived here. I'm 43. I think I've lived here for 21 or 22 years when I originally moved here to play arena football for the Fort Wayne Freedom. I still have a huge soft spot for. I'm from this little town in Ohio called Toronto, Ohio, maybe 6,000 people. And so every year we buy every kid on the football team a new pair of shoes and a bag. And then we help as much as we can with some of the other sports because, my hometown is kind of at the trail end or the trail beginning of Appalachia. And so, a lot of the income there was driven by coal and steel, which is all but gone from the area. And so, the largest, I would venture to guess the largest employer is maybe a hospital, followed closely by the Walmart distribution center. So not a lot of economic opportunity there. And so, my town is really good. There's amazing people there, but there's certainly some families that have fallen on a hard time. So easy for us to help in that situation.
Bobby, it's really Great, the things that you have decided together with your wife to do, you know, whether it's Ohio or Indiana, that are a product of how you came up. You're a person who's experienced success in life, but you haven't forgot where you came from or what it was like to be that kid that couldn't get the new shoes. Can you just talk a little bit about that? I mean, you're from a very working class family, hardworking parents, you know, and that's really made an impact. You're the person who remembers those days, but our listeners don't know that about you. They just know you as this successful businessman. So maybe you could tell them a little bit.
Yeah, so my parents' story is very interesting. My dad had a scholarship and played a year at the University of Marshall. So the year after the plane crash, so like the movie We Are Marshall is about my dad's, you know, freshman team. My mother is 5 years younger than my dad. So I'll let the listeners do the math. But my mom got pregnant when she was 16. So with my sister. In high school. And so, you know, my dad obviously, you know, had to make a decision to support the family. They got married. I think my mom was technically 17, eloped in Virginia. And so, you know, obviously struggled right out of the gate. My mom's in high school. You know, my dad is working at a mill at the time. Really struggled. And by the time that I was born 5 years later, my parents had got a new house and they couldn't afford it. And so the bank foreclosed on my parents' house. I'm a baby, so obviously I don't remember that. But we had to move into a house that was owned by my grandparents. And, you know, when people say dirt poor, I can attest to that because we had a dirt basement, okay? And so all kinds of stuff would come into this house. Well, I was probably like 4 or 5. I mean, this is really one of my first like core memories. My bedroom was in a hallway and my sister had her own room and she's 5 years older than me. And I had sworn that I saw, like a rat or something on the floor. And so I ran into my sister's room. I said, "Hey, can I sleep with you?" And she's like, "You know, no way, you're not sleeping with me." And, and so she's like, "But I'll tell you what, I'll give you the cat." So we have this cat named Pepper. So I took the cat. I mean, I'm like clutching this cat. And I wake up the next morning and there's a rat on the floor dead. That Pepper killed. And my sister, I woke up to my sister screaming, you know? And so yeah, like, I mean, we really struggled. So my mom, you know, trying to obviously, my mom and dad trying to raise two kids when they were really kids. And so we really struggled for, I mean, honestly, until I was in high school. My mom always had a couple of jobs. You know, my dad busted his butt, ended up working for really the same job at First Energy, worked at a power plant. And we didn't have any extra. Like when I say we weren't financially square, I mean, I mean that, but like we weren't poor. And my parents worked really hard to make sure that we had everything we needed. But I didn't get a new pair of shoes until my first new pair of shoes I ever got, I was 12 years old. And I was playing basketball, so I was a pretty good football player, pretty good baseball player, and I sucked at basketball, but I wanted to play. And so, crazy enough, I went to a Catholic school called St. Francis, all right? And I was number 25. And the number I just got issued yesterday at St. Francis is 25, so full circle moment there. But my mom comes to one of my games, and the first thing she says to me, she's like, "Look, like, you know, me and your dad don't allow you to quit things once you start it, but like if you want to quit, you can quit." And I'm like, "No, I'm telling you, like, I'm going to get better. And then the next game she comes to, she notices that like I'm the only kid that I have like really trashy shoes. I had a buddy, Richard Trascoma, that had a pair of Reebok pumps that like he didn't want anymore. And they were pretty beat up, but I'm like, "You know what? I can get this white shoe polish and I can make them look, you know, good." And so that white shoe polish had worn off and they looked like trash. And my mom was like, "We're going to get you a new pair of shoes." And so she took me to the mall, to the store called Kelly Mike's. And I got my first brand new pair of shoes that day. Nothing better.
And, you know, you're not the first successful person to come on this podcast and talk about how their upbringing helped to shape them into the person that they are today. And what do you think is the reason for that, overcoming that resilience at a young age has helped to build you into the person that you are today?
So I think there's a couple of things. Like, my parents had this crazy belief in me and my sister. And it was one of those things where it's not like, "Are you going to go to college?" It's, "Where are you going to go and what are you going to study?" Like, so that was like number one. Number two, I think when you're you grow up like that, you kind of have this like chip on your shoulder. When I go back and talk to the kids at Toronto, people used to make fun of us and call us river rats, and now we've like really adopted that. My dad wrote a book about it, and it's like, that's like, river rats are like ornery, downright like nasty, and they'll just kind of get the job done. I think that's part of it, but I have to tell you, like, you know, I've been very fortunate where, you know, I read a lot of success stories where like people didn't have like a good parent. Like, I had two amazing parents, to the point where my dad probably believed in me a little too much. But I'll tell you a really good story that like has stuck with me and I think really put me on a path of success, especially as it relates to sports. So when I was in eighth grade and you're going to become a freshman, you can go work out with the football team. And so, but you know, I couldn't drive. So my dad would have to drop me and take me there and drop me off and pick me up. So he picks me up one day and we're driving back home, and my dad turns to me like really serious and says, "You're going to be the starting quarterback on the varsity team next year." I was like, I started going into this like, I don't know, Dad, like, you know, Mark Kelly was the starting quarterback last year and he did graduate. I said, but I'm not anywhere as good as him. And he just jerks the car off. We're like on a bridge and he just turns to the side and he's like, he says, "F Mark Kelly." He's like, "If all you ever want to be as good as Mark Kelly, you'll never be good at anything. Because if you don't want to be the best, if your goal is not to be the absolute best, don't play." And I was just like, I mean, I kind of thought my dad was crazy, but at the same time, it lit this fire in me that I'm like, okay, yeah. Like, if my dad, obviously, like, I really trusted my dad. And if I, you know, if he believes in me, then yeah, maybe I can do it. So, and I mean, from that point forward, I was like, yeah, I'm going to do it. And guess what? I was the starting quarterback my freshman year on the varsity team. So.
It's incredible what someone believing in you can do for you, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. You know, especially when it's a parent and somebody you look up to who takes the time and looks you in the eyeball and tells you, "Here's what you're capable of." It's contagious.
100%. There's a great book called Born to Run. That, yeah. If you haven't read, it's amazing. And Jim Ryan, who's the first guy to break the 4-minute mile, right? His coach told him, he got on a bus, he wanted to be a 400 meter. He's like, "Ryan, you're going to be the first American ever run under 4 minutes." He never even thought about it. And that's what set him on that path. So it just takes one person.
That's right. And for you, that snowballed from, "I'm going to be the starting quarterback as a freshman." And it took you down a very successful football career.
Yeah. I mean, but I'll tell you, like, it was bumpy. So I went, I was a, you know, all state performer in, football and track, and then I was, you know, all conference in basketball. So I, you know, a very good high school career. I got a scholarship to go to the University of Findlay in Ohio, and I was there for a year, and I was the only freshman to letter that year. So I was the only one that didn't redshirt, and I played quarterback, and I was the backup quarterback. And then my coach got fired at the end. It was his first season, he got fired. So we have this new guy that comes in, his name's Dan Simrell. And he comes in and, like, you gotta understand, everyone knows, and I'm not like bragging, but I was the hardest working guy. Like, I'm the first guy there. I'm the last guy to leave. Like, I had a key to the rec center because I would go run sprints at night. I mean, I did everything I could, right? I didn't drink alcohol at all. And, so I was like just super focused. So this new guy comes in and all the new coaches that come in clearly say, like, "I'm the hardest working guy there." And so we have spring football. And the other guy that's the other quarterback, who's a phenomenal guy named Brian Heber, he and I are now in the same grade because he redshirted. And so now he's a redshirt sophomore. I'm a sophomore now. And so I thought I played really well in spring. My team beat his team in the spring game. And I'm thinking, I got a chance here, you know. So you have an exit interview in college football. So I go to my exit interview with Coach Simrell. And, like, immediately you can tell he's not a fan of me. And I was just like really blown back because I'd never had a coach to that point not like me or whatever, you know. And so I was just like, look, like, if I'm not going to have a chance to be a starting quarterback, I was all-state free safety in high school, or I can play receiver. And he's like, "You're not fast enough." I'm like, okay, I mean, you know, all right. And then it's like he starts going on this rant about these players he coached that are in the NFL and all this stuff. And I was just like, I'm trying to take the high road here. And I say, look, because at that time, you had to get released by your team to go play somewhere else. So I was like, look, you're probably the best coach I've ever had. And he goes, I know I'm a great coach. I don't need a kid to tell me that. And I was just like, whoa, okay. He's like, where do we go from here? And I was like, well, I guess I'd like my release so I could go play. And he just signed the paper and just like basically don't let the door hit you on the way out. So here I am, like, I have no team. And so I reached out to a couple of schools that had recruited me, Tiffin being one of them, you know, went luckily that, you know, they gave me a scholarship and let me go there. But I literally, like, that guy, Dan Simmerl, when they announced that he was the coach, I had happened to save that paper, and I kept that paper, and I had it on my dorm or apartment room wall every year I was in college. Like, he was my Drago, you know? And so, like, when I made it, you know, I was, like, my senior year in college, I was, like, conference player of the year, like, third in the nation in tackles, like, all these accolades, like, team MVP. And then when I made professional, I got my first football card. I got my football card, and I wrote him a letter, and I thanked him. I said, hey, I just want you to know, like, you didn't believe in me, and, like, that's the motivation I needed. And this is all the stuff I did, and, like, bam, you know. So sometimes you need someone to believe in you, and I think sometimes you need someone to tell you you suck.
Someone to dare you, someone to challenge you, and say, I really don't think you can do this. Yeah.
100%.
Yeah, it's so great to see you using something that could have been negative and could have set you back your career completely and using that as the fuel to the fire to really progress you. And you had a really successful career, and most Division II players don't really get opportunities to make the NFL, but you were able to have a chance at making that happen. So tell us a little bit more about that experience.
Yeah, so when I first finished, I got offered a contract by this team called the Cincinnati Swarm, and they were in the Arena Football League. The thing about the Arena Football League, though, is the season starts, like, really early, and I was still in school. And you got to understand, my ultimate goal is to make it to the NFL. So I had – the Lions had come to Tiffin and put me through, like, a pro combine, and I like, tested off the charts. Like, I can't remember if I did 22 or 26 bench presses at 225. I ran a really good 40, had some really good agility numbers. And so they really liked me, but they're like, hey, look, you're probably not on our first, like, invite list, you know, of undrafted guys. They hooked me up with this agent out of Detroit named Tom Tefelski, who's still a really good friend of mine. And so Tom gets me in this contract offer at Cincinnati, but I'm like, dude, if I go here, I got to drop out of school. And he's like, yeah, that's probably not what we're going to do. So I had tried out for the Fort Wayne team and didn't get a call back the first time. And then essentially when they heard that I had the Lions interested in me and this team in Cincinnati, they're like, hey, we got a spot for you. So I show up in Fort Wayne for a day of practice, and they cut the starting free safety, like, right in front of me. It was, like, the craziest thing. And I take over his job, play that weekend, have an interception on defense. I had a really good game. And then probably a month after that or something, Detroit brings me up for, like, a private workout. So I go up there and I test really well again. And they're like, hey, well, if we want you, we're going to invite you back up, you know, for another workout or whatever. So fast forward to the end of the season, it's July, and we're not going to make the playoffs. And so I had gone to the coach and said, hey, I'm not going to play the last game. Detroit asked me to come back up for another workout. And, so we go, my dad's up, but, like, we're packing up my stuff out of my apartment, and my phone rings, and the coach is like, look, we had a guy got hurt at practice. A couple guys are opting out. Is there any way you can play? He offers to pay me more money. I'm like, all right, fine, I'll do it. I have, like, the absolute game of my life, like, starting receiver, like, three or four catches, touchdown, two interceptions on defense, force a fumble, recover. I mean, I'm, like, game of my life. So there's, like, a minute to go in the game. Coach pulls me. I'm just watching. Guy that went in for me at receiver gets hurt. So I have to go back in. Next play, I go back in. We're just running the ball because we're winning. Guy, like, cuts off my block. The defender rolls into my leg, breaks my leg. 26 seconds left to go in the game. So, I mean, I'm, like, devastated. You know, my offside, can't go back up to Detroit. And then to make matters worse, like, my bone is hypertrophic. Like, it won't heal. It's my fibula bone. Should be healed in, like, 6 weeks. Mine takes 8 months. And, so, you know, so I spent the next 2.5 years trying to get back to the level that I was. You know, I was a 4.440 guy. I had a huge vertical. I mean, I lost a step. And then the next year I had surgery. I have chronic shin splints. I broke my elbow, you know. So I really just trying to piece it together. So then my third year, I'm like almost healthy, and I get traded to a team in Wheeling, West Virginia. And I end up playing like 3 games for them. And I played really well. And that was really the way that I planned my career to end. So that was in like 2005, all right? 2009, I get a call from my friend who bought the team here in Fort Wayne. And he's like, "Are you in shape?" I'm like, "Well, yeah, I'm always in shape. What's up?" He's like, "I need you to play." I'm like, "Play what?" He's like, "Football." So I'm like, look, I'm like every other guy in America who thinks they've got one more game in them. So I show up. Nope. We didn't have any practice either. Like, I show up to the game, and somehow we win this game. I did not play very well. Somehow we win that game, make the playoffs, win another game, and then we end up losing to the Chicago Rush in the championship that year. But it was a pretty cool, like, That right there would have just been like, you know, fairy tale ending if we won the championship. But I'm here to tell you that you do not have one more game in you. I was definitely not as good a player as I was. But I got a jersey and a helmet out of it. So.
That's so great. And with having that, you'd worked so hard in college. You talked about not drinking alcohol, staying, running the extra sprints, everything. You put in so much time, and you came so close to a goal that I bet you had from a very young age that you've been driven towards and working towards. So how were you able to kind of get yourself over that from becoming so close to making the NFL, which only a small percent of the population get a chance to do something like that, and you get it taken away from you by a brutal injury? How were you able to refocus, refuel, retool, and keep moving forward after something like that?
So I think in hindsight, the reason I wanted to be a professional athlete was to take care of my family and you know, others around me. And so in hindsight, like, I've done that, right? Like, you know, my sister and I have created we have 3,500 employees. We made my dad retire from the mill. He's been working for us for probably a decade now. My mom's worked for us for 15 years. She runs our human resources department. You know, my wife works for us. We've had various family members work for us. So, you know, I've been able to give my wife and I and my sister and I, we've been able to give back a lot. Like, I think that my goal has been achieved in that sense. I had a tough time, man, like, not being an athlete. The hardest thing, and I tell kids this all the time that I mentor, that, you know, if you're a college athlete, when you go home for Thanksgiving or Christmas and someone asks you, "Hey, what are you doing?" "I'm a basketball player. I'm a football player." The first time you have to say, "I'm a sales rep" versus an athlete, it is tough. So I had a really tough adjustment when I got finished, because I really wasn't sure what I was going to do. I started running 5Ks. My last year playing football, I was like 235 pounds. And I got down to like 175 pounds to run these 5Ks, because the only way you can run fast is if you're light, you know. So I was doing that, and then, I don't know, then I started, you know, weightlifting like I did when I was playing football and gained a bunch of weight. But, you know, then I fell into jiu-jitsu with your uncle and, you know, did that for 6 or 7 years, like high level. Like, I won a Naga, you know, won a bunch of different, you know, grappling, you know, jiu-jitsu competitions. And then
can I just say shout out to the Lee brothers and all they had going on in their garage. And then, I mean, they're in a nice facility now, but you were with them in the garage days, but they taught you how to grapple. Didn't matter where they were.
Literally their dad's garage. And then I end up turning, because I lived in Wayndale at the time. I had the crazy Dave actually calls me one day, because he was like the assistant wrestling coach or something. He's like, "Hey, we're getting new mats and we're not allowed to give them away. But I'm just telling you, they're going to be at the dumpster at whatever time." And so, like, I literally went and got Wayne's old wrestling mats. And then that's how my garage was. And so it was, we had this guy in our camp, Anthony Lapsley, and he was, he, at the time, he's like the king of the cage champ, and he just got a UFC contract. Well, I'm the biggest guy there. Anthony fought at 185, and so I became his main punching dummy, you know, basically. And, you know, I'm training with Ant every day, every single day for like a couple of months. And I remember we're doing some stand-up work, and I hit him, and I, like, stunned him. And then I, you know, and then, like, a couple days later, I submitted him. And so we go down to this place called the Dragons down in Muncie, and it's all the King of the Cage guys and the heavyweight champs there, the guy that's my weight's there. And we're just running through these guys, like, submitting them. And Anthony's manager comes up to me. He's like, "You're going to fight." And I was like, "Nah, I don't want to fight." He's like, "I got a fight next weekend at the Armory down in Indianapolis, and you're going to be on the card." So I'm like, "Well," I was like, "you know, it kind of works out because my wife's out of town, and we didn't have kids yet." And so I'm not even going to tell her because I knew she did not want me to fight. So you know, I'm a jiu-jitsu guy, and I could stand up, but I was always, you know, like, I'm getting on the ground. So we get down to the fight, and we had this saying in the gym when new people would come in, we're doing stand-up. A lot of times they throw purses. They put their chin up in the air, you know, and they kind of go like this. So we get in the cage. This guy that I'm going against, he's like tattoos, like all the way up here. And you know, they lock the cage, and I'm like, "Oh crap, like this is for real," you know? And so, you know, we come out to the center of the ring, and I start throwing purses, man. Like, my chin's up in the air. Like, I've done all this training and I can't believe it. And then I'm like, "I got to take him down." So I double leg this guy, but I hit him off the cage and he falls in full mount on top of me. And he's, you know, he's like hitting me. And it's not hurting, but in my mind, I'm like, man, if they stop the fight, I'm gonna be so embarrassed. So I shrimp out, grab this guy's arm. Like, he gives me no resistance, and I armbar him and I break his arm. Like, elbow pops through the wrong way. Like, you know, I jump on, like a caveman, I jump on the top of the cage, like, "Ah," I'm screaming. And so they have to clear all of the chairs out of the arena and bring an ambulance in. And they, like, had to tape cast this guy's arm up. So we get back to the locker room. I can't even lift my arms. Like, Lapsley's like, he's like, "Hold my arms, cut my thing." Like, I literally can't move. And I'm like, "Dude, I'm so exhausted. Like, I can't believe I let that guy take me to, like, the end of the first round." And he's like, "Petrus, that fight was 36 seconds. I'm like, "What?" He's like, "You have adrenaline dump." And I was like, So, yeah. That was
cool. Yeah, Lapsley is definitely one of the big names to come out of Northeast Indiana wrestling. Very well known in the area for his accomplishments. And, you know, you really got to be under some great people in that stage of your career. You know, 100%. I love the fact that no matter what happens to you, you are unafraid to reinvent yourself. And you know, we recently released a podcast on one of Ricardo's rules of resilience. It's success is getting up one more time than you get knocked down. And you did that athletically, and you did that in business too. You got fired, and instead of find a new job, you say, "We'll just open up our own company."
It's true. Yeah. So, you know, when my sister came home for Thanksgiving dinner, with an easel, with like a business plan, right? It's like, "We're all going to quit our jobs and we're going to start this company." And, you know, she brought some wine home too. So we thought, you know, cheers in. Yeah. And like you said, like one by one, we either, you know, quit our jobs or got fired. I got fired from my job. And so, like, I really went all in. So, like, we went all in. My wife got pregnant with our first, and, you know, we really didn't have a choice but to go all in at that point. The crazy thing is, we had an equity partner at the time. My sister did, and this guy helped bankroll us and get us up to speed. And the scariest thing that we did was in 2015. He goes to my sister and says, "Hey, I'm getting out of the business. So, like, you guys got to figure stuff out." And we really didn't have enough money to buy him out. And so, you know, here we are again. Now we've got a second kid. And, you know, we have amassed a little bit of wealth, but not a lot. Like, I mean, we really were just workers, you know. And so we were just kind of going to go our separate ways. Like, my sister was going to go back into banking. You know, I was going to try to get a job in the industry. And my sister, who's a lot like me, is just like, "You know what? Let's figure this out." Like, so we didn't have enough money, but we went to this conference that I literally just got back from Wednesday. And we just went basically begging for a deal. Like, "Hey, like, we don't have a lot of money, but, like, if someone will just give us a little bit, we can buy this guy out and we're going to, you know, we're going to make it." And so we did. We found this one group that would give us a deal. But my wife and I had to cash in our 401ks for the second time just to make it happen. And so we get this deal, and it's going pretty good, right? But we then need a gap, like we need money to kind of sustain operations. So my wife and I went and put our house up to get a line of credit. And it's literally like, if this doesn't work, like, we're going to lose our house, we're going to lose our business, and I don't know what we're going to do. And so while it was scary, it's like, when you don't give yourself a backup plan, like, that's when you can really do something. If you have a backup plan, you're already telling yourself, if you fail, it's okay.
That's exactly right. You got to burn the ships behind you. And instead of asking yourself, this is what we tell people, it's one of our rules of resilience. Hey, instead of asking, what if I fail, ask, what if I succeed? You know, yeah. And the only thing on your mind is, I have to succeed at this. I didn't pack a parachute, so we can't bail on this plane. We got to fly.
Right, exactly.
Just about to say that burning the ship, such a key aspect, no turning back after that. Yep. And it looks like, if I'm right, that you're in a college parking lot right now, if I'm not mistaken. So what is a 43-year-old guy doing in a college parking lot right now?
Well, I'm in the Coliseum parking lot because I own this company called the Masters Fitness Championship, and we put on a big CrossFit competition every year in Fort Wayne. We have about 1,000 athletes come in from all over the world. It's been a little challenging with the hurricane stuff, but 3-day competition, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, pretty amazing. But I've got my St. Francis basketball shirt on. I do have to go to campus here in a couple hours for practice. And, you know, got this crazy idea to play some college basketball. And I've been with the team, you know, in some capacity since last winter. And then, you know, train with them in off-season workouts all summer. And then, you know, school started about 6 weeks ago. So we've been kind of in the thick of it. You know, when I first started, you know, when I first got the idea to try to play college basketball at 43, you know, very selfishly, it's like, man, I just want to get in a game, you know, score a point or whatever. And, you know, now I realize, like, my purpose has really been to mentor the kids and be, you know, maybe be a better example or whatever. And I've given these kids some better opportunities that they didn't have. You know, we've been able to support the program in a way that I don't think anybody has in the past. So yeah, if I get my eligibility is granted, because I'm going through my second appeal right now, you know, fantastic. And I get to play in a couple of games. Awesome. But, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to work out the way it's going to work out. And I'm going to leave with a great experience. And, you know, I've put in the work, and I've always put in the work. Like, that's never been my problem. You know, and if I don't get the score point in the game, then I'm not going to be upset.
The biggest super senior, like a 10th year senior or something.
Something like that, yeah. You know, it's funny because I've got, you know, my undergrad from Tiffin. I have a master's degree from Tiffin, and now I'm enrolled in a couple of classes because you have to be enrolled in classes to play. But I will not finish this degree. So,
you know, that faith that you just mentioned, another key aspect of resilience we see in people is that belief in something greater than themselves. And, you know, you're talking about, hey, if my dream works out the way I dreamt it, great, but I might find a deeper purpose along the way, a deeper purpose in the disappointment. Can you just talk a little bit about the role faith plays in your life?
Yeah, you know, we talked about this, I think, before we started recording, but, you know, I grew up Catholic, went to Catholic school, actually went to St. Francis Elementary School. Now that I'm in, you know, St. Francis University, I think it's funny. And, you know, this past year in January, I made a goal to read the Bible every single day. Like, that's how I started my day. Every day I get in the sauna. And then I'd read the Bible, and then I'd get my cold plunge, and that's like really how I start my day. And like the when I read some of this stuff when I was a kid versus reading it as a 43-year-old, it's just completely, you know, different meaning to me. And I think one of my biggest takeaways was, you can have the greatest intentions and you can have the best plan, but God has like a different plan for you, and you have to be willing to accept that and adapt. And like for me, again, like, there's a lot of things I think people do, myself included, with very selfish intentions. Like, my selfish intention drove me to want to play college basketball. And then as I got into it, it's like, oh my God, man, these kids are so great. It's invigorating to be around kids that are driven, because you actually end up spending time with a lot of adults that aren't. They achieved some sort of success, but they kind of lost their drive. These kids are all like, my dreams are in front of me. I can do it. And so my thing has been giving them access to things that they didn't have, like sports performance training. We bought the kids, they have access to protein drinks after workouts every day, access to electrolyte drinks, recovery tools, like things that smaller universities can't afford to do. And the other thing I tell these kids is that, like, you can go to workout every day, but if you don't learn why you're doing it, like, you miss the whole point, because knowledge is power. Once you know how to work out, once you know what to eat, you know, we've hooked them up with a nutrition expert. Like, when you know what to eat and why you're doing it, you can do it on your own. You don't need someone to tell you, right? So I think that's been a big eye-opener for me, is that, like, I started this selfishly, but I'm now kind of on a different path.
You think with God has a better plan for you? Obviously, it's never easy to burn the ships. That's never an easy decision to make. But do you think having that faith in God's plan makes it a little bit easier to make that decision to burn the boats?
100%. I mean, look, I've said this for years. I have a really good friend that went through a bad divorce, and, you know, I mean, some other stuff had happened to him. And when you talk to him, like, I'm not saying he wasn't upset, but he was just like, hey, man, it's not my plan, it's God's plan. I was like, remember I told my wife, I was like, I am so envious of the way that he just took that on. It's like, all right, I'm going to, you know, it's going to work out for me, that I'd be lying to you if I had that sort of resiliency, like, because it is a tough, tough thing. I mean, if you read the Bible, there are people that God is literally telling them to do something and they don't do it. Right. You know, so yeah. I give myself some grace for that, because it is still really hard to take. And I think sometimes it's further on down the line that you accept it. But the faster you can do it, the better off you are.
That's super powerful, and I love the insight you have on that. And as we close time, one of the questions we like to ask all our guests is, maybe me and Coach didn't ask you some of the best questions. So if there's one thing that you want to let the viewers know, that this is your time to let them know.
You know, I would just say, like, you know, one of the guiding principles of really all our companies is talk. You know, be open, right? Like, for our main business, Priority Life Care, it's talk to the residents, talk to the family members, talk to your coworkers, and even, like, our vendor partners. The second thing is listen. You know, be open-minded. Listen to what other people have to tell you. Some people really just need an ear to bend, you know? I think people take advantage or take for granted that a lot of people don't have maybe as strong a family, you know, like as you guys do, and I think as I do. Like, they just need someone to listen, right? And the third thing, and I always say this is literally the most important thing, is don't be an asshole. And, like, you know, I really think you can be successful in this world and be nice. I don't, you know, like, I really do believe, like, being nice, you can be successful. And I don't know why in the last decade it's become this battle cry to be mean to people, and that's the way you get things done. Like, I really truly believe being nice gets you a lot further along than being mean.
That is very good insight, and I really deeply appreciate you as a business leader, as a very successful athlete and businessman, being willing to throw the gauntlet down and to be countercultural in that way and say, look, you don't have to trash other people. It's not a matter of stepping on other people for you to climb up, right? All of us have had that experience where someone feels like for them to be successful, they need to put others down. And here you are doing very well in your business. You've done very well in your sporting career. And you're saying, no, guys, guess what? There's a better way. 100%. There's a higher road to take.
I remember getting made fun of when I was a kid for having, like, dirty clothes, you know. And I went home to my parents, and I'm, you know, I'm crying. I'm upset. My dad's like, they're only making fun of you because they're jealous. I'm like, jealous of what? They're jealous I have dirty clothes? And he's like, I'm telling you, they're jealous of something. Like, they either think you're better looking or, like, you're more athletic. He's like, because successful people don't make fun of other people. And it, like, really struck with me. And you know what? You know what successful people do?
That's good.
They build other people up. They look at the kid with dirty clothes and they say, how can I help you? Like, what's going on, right? So I'll tell you one more story that I've been playing basketball a lot, right? And so I go to this place called The Summit. It's the old Anderson University. I'm the only white guy there. And it's normally like younger kids. I'm always the last guy picked, which is fine. I'm the oldest guy. And so, but when I get on there, like I bust my butt and we win a lot of games. Well, there's these two kids that, there's a lot of guys talking trash. These two kids don't talk trash. These two kids head down. I don't care if they get hit in the mouth. They don't say anything. They keep playing. They keep playing. Well, I noticed that one kid has duct tape on his shoes. Okay. I'm the duct tape shoe kid. So like I see this, but this kid works so hard. So I go to the guy that does the runs, and I'm like, hey, what's the deal with these kids? They're like, listen, like, single family, dad takes care of them, just the best kids. And I'm like, hey, would they mind if I bought them a pair of shoes? No, I don't think so. So my wife and I bought these two kids, two brothers' shoes, and we invited them to the University of St. Francis. They just thought they were coming there to work out. I gave them the shoes. Like, they didn't even know how to open the shoebox. Like, I had to show them how to open the shoebox, you know what I mean? So give these kids shoes, and then we gave them free sports performance training, and like they're there every day. And the coach is like, they're the hardest working kids. But like, that's my point. Like, those are the kids with dirty clothes, and it's so easy to make fun of them. But why don't you help them out? Because those two kids, I guarantee you, will work harder than any two kids that have everything handed to them.
You're absolutely right. We focus too much on external and not enough on internal. And the people with the internal drive, right, for success and to be people of character, right? Those are the ones to support and build up. And the ones who are stepping on everybody else and feel like it's necessary to tear others down to build up. Those are actually the ones we should kind of be avoiding and looking out for. But instead, people are drawn to and run to that. And I just love the fact that you're willing to look at the people who aren't as popular, who aren't as, you know, don't have the exterior shell, don't have the right mask, the right costume, right? But they got the right character on the inside. I tell you, that speaks to my heart, man. I really appreciate what you're saying there.
Yeah, great stuff overall. And if someone is in the Fort Wayne, Indiana, and looking to train with you, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
You check out MattAppleCrossFit.com, Matt Apple Fitness. I think all my information is probably on there. I think I'm listed as a coach. Feel free to reach out to me on any of those.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time. There's a lot of great information that we got from this, and I know the listeners are going to love this. So if you're interested in doing DECA coaching with me, there are going to be Google Forms in the descriptions of this video for DECA training or resilience coaching with Coach Ricardo. If you want to reach out to me personally, I'm on Instagram at AltonMolinex17_ or on Facebook at Coach Alton. What's the best way to get in touch with you, Coach?
Well, I just love conversations like this where we talk about resilience and what it takes to withstand and recover from difficulties. We could talk about this all day long. So if your group or your team would like someone to come talk to them about resilience, get in touch with me at coach.ricardo on Instagram or Ricardo Molinex on Facebook. I'd love to help you out one-to-one or speaking to your group about resilience. Bobby Petras, it has been a wonderful time together. I'm looking forward to the day when you and I get to do a DECA together, maybe as a team relay.
As soon as I'm done playing basketball, I'm in.
But I was going to say, I bet it's going to have to wait until after this season's over when the 43-year-old man finishes his final semester as a college athlete. Thank you so much.
Season 2 of Ricardo's Rules of Resilience podcast is brought to you by RamFit. Here at RamFit, we take material destined for landfill and turn it into high-performance training gear that lasts because we believe we can have fitter people and a fitter planet. In the dynamic world of fitness equipment, our indestructible training tools made from recycled materials promises to revolutionize your workouts and deliver unmatched durability. By embracing the RamFit philosophy, you're not only enhancing your workouts, but also contributing to a more sustainable future. RamFit. Fitter people, fitter planet.